This week on Making Contact.
We don't look at homelessness as a disaster anymore, and I think that's our problem. It's part of the fabric of society that unfortunately we've come to accept.
Public housing has always been the housing of last resort for the poorest of the poor. If it's not there, they are rendered homeless. They are the ones in the most desperate need. They wind up out on the street.
It would take a revolutionary change at the federal level to be able to supply people with what they minimally need.
On this edition, we take a look at poverty in the U.S., homelessness, economic injustice, and a dwindling federal safety net that has left millions of Americans in dire straits. Where is the support, and why is there so much poverty in a land of plenty? I'm Tina Rubio, your host this week on Making Contact, a program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Although the issue of poverty is not new to this country, Hurricane Katrina certainly brought the problem to the forefront of America's consciousness. Images of destruction and displaced people wading through the chemical soup that flowed through the streets of New Orleans had many asking, are those really images in the U.S.? Right now, the U.S. Census Bureau reports 13% of the population in 2004 lived at or below the poverty line. In a nation of nearly 300 million, that's about 39 million who can't make ends meet, 39 million who have little or no way to change their condition. Of course, statistics vary from state to state and city to city, but they clearly show far too many Americans are in deep and lasting economic trouble. And many of these people are people of color. Making Contact's Christian Roseland is in New Orleans, Louisiana, where nearly 30% of the people lived below the poverty line before Katrina hit. He reports on the patchwork of poverty and hardship endured by those living on the fringes of the world's richest nation.
Working from payday to payday
until I can find someone better to live.
They don't have no money anyway.
They say the poor will always be among us, and here in the land that gave the world the blues, where the Mississippi winds its way into the Gulf of Mexico, just living day to day has long been a feat for many. Louisiana and Mississippi have the highest percentages of people living in poverty in the nation, with 1 in 3 children under the age of 5 living below the federal poverty line.
I see Hurricane Katrina as a washout and providing an x-ray of how things are here.
Katrina just is a lens that focuses attention on it. But it's nothing new.
And that's what you were looking at when you were looking at them black kids that was about to die.
The world saw the images of refugees crammed into superdomes and astrodomes, fleeing with the clothes on their backs to uncertain futures. And many asked, where did these people come from? How could this happen here in America?
You know, well, it's like a slap in the face. It's like being over, let me kick you for not having enough money to pay for flood insurance.
Shirley Jones has been a resident of the Lower Ninth Ward since 1969. She says FEMA won't give her aid because she is poor. Difficulty in obtaining what so many in the United States take for granted is nothing new to Jones.
In the past in my life, my electric had been turned off. I had to wait until I make a payday to go get it. In the past, the same thing with my telephone. In the past in my life with medicine, it's either when I got paid, pay my rent, or get my medicine. So I had to pay the rent first and wait for another 2 weeks to get my medicine. That's how my life have been, working from payday to payday. And how do you expect me to afford insurance?
But Jones is more fortunate than many across the nation. That's because she owns the house she lived in, as many in her neighborhood did, despite being in one of the poorest parts of the city. Jones loves her home, and now she's fighting to get it back.
I have the letter where they say they're not assisting me, but they're not giving me nothing. My case is closed for non-flood insurance.
Social workers here will verify that conditions before Katrina were the worst in the nation. Karen Mason worked in public health for the city of New Orleans during the 80s and 90s. Her eyes get moist when she talks about what she saw while working in the Women, Infants, and Children program, or WIC. Mason says she saw many who had hit rock bottom.
Maybe 1 out of 10 families who came for WIC as chronically poor to the point where they didn't have the energy to bathe, And they often had poor clothes that were poorly fitting and not washed. And they had body odor that told me that they didn't have easy access to bathing. They were sweaty and unbathed and poorly nourished.
Mason says this level of poverty is worse in New Orleans than in other states she has worked in, something not surprising to those that live here. The South is historically agricultural and has never had the industrial base the North has, and as a result, never had the large numbers of often unionized, high-paying factory jobs that formed a way of life for generations of Americans. More importantly, what wealth is here has never been distributed in an equitable manner.
Race and class together in the most highest concentrated form in America is here in Louisiana.
Russell Henderson, a professor of social work at Dillard University in New Orleans, says that the Gulf Coast is characterized by social and economic divisions that are based upon skin color and access to education. He says that the current state of the Gulf Coast is a continuation of the same forms of social organization that the South has been laboring under for centuries.
We had the old plantation system replaced by the new plantation system.
Many point to the failing public school system and say that a poorly educated workforce discourages employers from bringing skilled jobs to the region. In New Orleans, most public schools have been taken over by the state, and the few that are reopening after Katrina have selective admission standards. But many say they saw the failing public schools as merely a preparation for another institution, the prison system. Curtis Muhammad is a spokesperson for Community Labor United, the organization that initiated the People's Hurricane Relief Fund in New Orleans. He's among those who say the school system doesn't provide a future for many.
And the school systems in this town had just become the modern-day slave ships, where we take the kids, flunk them out with the high-stakes tests without educating them. They criminalize them, give them drugs, give them guns, they go to jail and work for slavery as slaves.
And adding to the hardships now is the experience of being displaced. Karen Mason, a Katrina evacuee, spent time in FEMA shelters in other states before returning home to New Orleans.
I can't imagine how traumatic it is to be poor in your city and then to be evacuated and be pushed around in other cities too.
Many who left are now fighting to keep their homes and lives together. Patty lived in the Lewisburg Square apartments in the Tarrytown suburb of New Orleans. She says that being denied housing is part of the evacuee experience, both here and in other cities.
Throw everybody this way and that way. People don't even know how to get back to their house. That's sad. If they don't have no money anyway, half of them went up there, and people throw them out on the street. And I know this for a fact, because my sister's in Atlanta, and she said little boy was asking her, could she help feed his mom on them? They had come from New Orleans. And they were putting out the hotel up there.
But as one longtime New Orleans resident says, people in the South are strong and know how to survive. Carolyn Bauman has lived all her life in the 7th Ward. She says that facing hardships and surviving is part of the history of the city.
And you learn a lot from those struggling experiences because, like, we've had this devastation to happen here in New Orleans now. Many, many people are going to be able to make it because we used to struggle, and it took us years, it took us 30 and 40 years to acquire what we have now, but they have been 30 and 40 of struggling years, so we are used to struggling.
As for Shirley Jones, she says she will be back to her house and to her neighborhood.
You just have to fight for it. I'm going back there. You just have to shoot me. I live back there all my life, so I know how to get back there. I gotta crawl. I'm not stopping.
For Making Contact, I'm Christian Roseland.
We'll have more in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for a CD copy of this program, call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. It's said people who are homeless are the poorest of the poor, and more than 840,000 adults and children in the U.S. are reportedly homeless in a given week, as many as 3.5 million over the course of a year. That's according to the National Resource Center on Homelessness and Mental Illness. They report nearly half of those who are homeless work at least part-time, bringing in only about $370 a month. The median U.S. household makes more than 7 times that. In a land of plenty, many ask why. Officials say deep and persistent federal housing cuts, gentrification, and jobless recoveries have all contributed to a crisis in affordable housing. Many Americans have nowhere else to turn but the streets. Making Contact's Martha Baskin is in Seattle, Washington, where the city's public housing is in crisis.
Teresa Higgins Brown has lived at Yesler Terrace since 1988. She's raising 4 children. On a sunny day, we stand outside the community center. The Olympic Mountains and Mount Rainier are a cinematic backdrop.
It's beautiful. It has a wonderful view. It's a quiet place, if you get the right place. And I love it. I have 3 bedrooms, actually. And I have a big yard, and I have a kitchen that I can work with. I have a bathroom. I have a nice yard.
But Teresa is worried. She's just received a letter from the Housing Authority outlining new rules. The 7-day window for receiving rents will be discontinued, something that will hurt people on fixed incomes, she says, who often don't receive money until the 1st or 2nd of the month.
I think that's their way of just getting the process started of downsizing, because in order to build this, they had to destroy some units.
One of them was Teresa's old unit. The Seattle Housing Authority, who own Yesler Terrace, is one of 200 across the country. It says redevelopment of the low-income housing site is only a matter of time. Officials maintain that it needs significant upkeep. They add that because budget cuts for low-income housing have been in the 20% range since Bush took office in 2001, the only way to rebuild the property is as a mixed-use and mixed-income development. Seattle Housing Authority Executive Director Tom Tierney.
We're starting the process to discuss both with the residents and with the rest of this community what would be the proper mix of uses on that site. And if you could get a mix of uses such that the low-income housing can be rebuilt because of the revenues that we can get off of the use of that big land asset, that's one way to rebuild low-income housing into the distant future.
The mixed-use and mixed-income approach, which has a track record in Seattle as well as the nation, doesn't sit well with housing advocates. 4 local public housing communities were recently redeveloped with the mixed-income approach, resulting in a serious loss of low-income units.
Ostensibly, it was argued that they needed to renovate these buildings, redevelop them, and we needed to, quote-unquote, deconcentrate the poor.
John Fox with the Seattle Displacement Coalition.
The claim was made these units were seriously deteriorated, but in the end, it became really just a rationale to move to serving a higher income, a higher class of people. And the net effect was a loss of over 1,000 public housing units.
Fox and other community advocates have been organizing to fight the redevelopment of Yesler Terrace. They want no net loss of low-income housing on site. Barring winning over the Housing Authority, they'd like the City Council to assert its legal authority over the Housing Authority and take an active role in the project. Community housing advocates consider redevelopment just another word for pushing the poor out of town to the fringes of the county. Community Coalition for Environmental Justice Executive Director Yolanda Singe says the larger issue is one of the government moving away from serving the poor and toward privatization.
Housing authorities sold all of us out. And they whine and they complain about, oh, well, the government stopped allocating enough money for us to renovate the public housing. Well, why then didn't you advocate for what you needed? All the housing authorities nationally could have advocated for poor people, but they didn't do that. They saw dollar signs for developers, their friends in real estate, each other, and they grabbed the money and ran.
The wait list for public housing at the Seattle Housing Authority is up to 5 years. There were 8,600 families on the list as of September 2005. The list was closed over a year ago because of cutbacks to the Section 8 voucher program and the shortage of available housing. It's late morning outside the Plymouth Housing Group rental office. Plymouth is one of an estimated 50 nonprofits in Western Washington trying to take up the slack in federal public housing. Plymouth provides 750 units of affordable housing for people who are coming from homelessness. A man who calls himself Tom sits in the rental office. He's hesitant at first, but slowly begins to share his story.
The reason I am homeless is my wife of 20 years and my 14-year-old boy got killed in a head-on car wreck. So the depression set in.
Tom says he left the city he'd been living in, Tacoma, 30 miles south of Seattle, because of the memories. He couldn't sustain his contracting business, so he sold the family home, paid off debts, and tried to start over in Seattle. He heard about Plymouth and put himself on their wait list for housing. He's been waiting for about 10 months and hopes to get in soon. Tom pauses and adjusts his windbreaker.
It's really tough out there, especially in the wintertime. Because I was homeless last winter, and this winter doesn't even look any much better.
So now you're here now. I mean, what are you here to do right now?
You have to check in every month to make sure that you're still on the list. I'm here to use the phone to try to check on a couple of resumes that I have out because I'm pretty much at the desperate point of eating. I haven't eaten in 2 days damn near, and I got to get something going today.
Tom says he's constantly looking for work. He says his appearance isn't too bad and that he just shaved at Seattle's urban rest stop. That's a rest stop for the homeless that took years to be built because of heavy business opposition. Tom continues. He says he never asks anybody for money.
I usually try to earn it.
How do you do that? How do you earn even just basics?
Right now I'm with a place called Command Labor, and they send you out. But, you know, when I was in business, I was charging $35 an hour. I'm going out to work for $7.50 an hour. And that's a big thing to swallow, too.
But Tom says that isn't guaranteed either. On this particular day, he says he sat in the command and labor-ready offices from 5:30 in the morning until 11 and came away with nothing.
So where are you sleeping tonight then?
Actually, I have a little camp outside Airport Avenue. It's pretty concealed behind bushes and things. I have my bedroll and stuff there. It's already been gone through a few times. All my good stuff has always all been taken, so... That's where I sleep.
On any given day in Seattle, says John Fox with Seattle's Displacement Coalition, there are more than 6,000 homeless in the city with only 3,000 available shelter beds. Fox places the blame squarely on long-standing federal housing policies that have shortchanged the poor. Nonprofit housing, generally speaking, serves a mixed income population.
Whereas public housing has always been the housing of last resort for the poorest of the poor. If it's not there, the people that housing served, if that housing is not there, they are rendered homeless. They are the ones in the most desperate need. They wind up out on the street.
But that's not stopping affordable housing advocates and nonprofits from strategizing. Seattle, like other cities and municipalities around the country, has begun a 10-year plan to end homelessness, a public and private partnership started by the National Alliance to End Homelessness in Washington, D.C. The plan involves changing the overall availability of housing by building permanent supportive housing and tailoring solution-oriented approaches more directly to the needs of homeless populations. Absent any changes at the federal level, the 10-year plan looks like it's one of the few viable solutions on the horizon. For Making Contact, I'm Martha Baskin.
New Haven, Connecticut is a long way from the balmy shores of the U.S. Gulf Coast. Yet almost all areas of the New England city came together to welcome Katrina evacuees to come and settle there. Then two things happened. Few evacuees accepted the offer, and local people living in poverty, along with their supporters, wondered why the city never took such extraordinary steps to help them. Making Contact's Melinda Tuhus is in New Haven and has more.
They have been very wonderful. It's like angels. They're angels.
That's what Kelly Delgado says about the people in Greater New Haven who are helping her recover from the trauma of Hurricane Katrina. The New Orleans resident and her toddler are among the 35 families who self-evacuated in September from the Gulf Coast to this mid-sized New England city. Over Labor Day weekend, right after Katrina hit, New Haven Mayor John DeStefano called together representatives of city departments, private nonprofits, and the business community. They coordinated a detailed plan to welcome 100 families who survived the hurricane to stay in New Haven temporarily or permanently. Kelly Delgado describes the help she's received.
The kind of help they provide for me was housing. They provided with us with clothes, toiletries, gift cards, jackets, gift certificates for ShopRite and Stop and Shop, stuff like that.
The city also coordinated job counseling and placement, health services, and mental health counseling for the expected evacuees. And while everyone here acknowledged the rightness of reaching out to help people who have lost everything, many also felt conflicted because so many local people are also waiting for help. Madeline Goodwin is president of Mothers for Justice, a group of women on welfare or formerly on welfare that advocates for low-income New Haveners.
They need to give it to the homeless right here. It's just like they neglected our homeless to bring them. They need to address the homeless right here in New Haven. They push in, they say they're giving them jobs. I'm unemployed. I've been unemployed for 4 years. And they need to give us jobs before they're giving everybody else jobs.
Mayor DeStefano responds.
I think I understand the point of folks who would say, geez, you know, it seemed like a higher degree of attention was paid to these folks from out of state. What about us? Well, there's some truth in that. I mean, there was a higher degree of attention paid to these folks out of state because there was a higher degree of need.
In the end, many fewer families came than the city had prepared for. Most who came had relatives or other ties in the area, and many did not need all the services that were offered. But the whole episode exposed the poverty and desperation in New Haven and the region.
We know that there are people in Connecticut today that are facing what we're calling chronic storms.
Douglas Hall is a researcher with Connecticut Voices for Children, a research and advocacy group focused on low-income families.
And these are people who are struggling every day to deal with the sorts of, you know, lack of housing, lack of adequate food that we saw happening to the people down in the hurricane section during Katrina. So for us, this is sort of an opportunity to use this time to really emphasize the fact that poverty is an ongoing condition throughout the United States and also in Connecticut, which is the wealthiest state in the wealthiest country of the world.
Connecticut had very low unemployment in the 1990s, but it has risen steadily and is now slightly above the national average of 4.8%. And while the state minimum wage is $7.10 an hour, almost $2 more than the federal minimum, Hall points out that amounts to less than $16,000 for full-time, year-round work, hardly enough to support an individual, much less a family. The state minimum wage jumps to $7.65 in 2007, still not a livable income, especially when you consider that Connecticut is the sixth most expensive state in the country for rental housing. To afford a two-bedroom apartment, a single head of household would have to earn $18 an hour, on average. Two-thirds of families in Connecticut are homeowners, paying a mortgage instead of rent, but the state ranks 48th in minority home ownership. Since owning a home is the largest source of wealth for most families, this low percentage has a devastating impact on the ability of people of color to move out of poverty. Bill Villano, head of the Workforce Alliance, is the man in charge of job training for South Central Connecticut. He says he was prepared to send hurricane evacuees to the front of the line for jobs and training because their need was so great. That didn't sit well with Carolyn McClendon, who works with Mothers for Justice.
They were going to get job developers to develop jobs for these people coming in here. And I thought, now how is that possible when you have people here that need employment, and yet no one has ever said they would develop jobs for the people that live here?
Villano says most of the funding for job training comes from the federal government, but it covers just 10% of workers' training and placement needs.
The state, like many states, relies almost exclusively for its job development, job placement needs on federal dollars. And those dollars over time have been cut back, and I would say not because the need has been cut back. And those dollars from 1985 to 2003, which is the latest study that we've looked at, have decreased about a third, which is fairly significant. And I would say that given the traffic that we see and the four one-stop career centers that we have in this region, that the need is increasing.
Without a job, it's often hard to put food on the table. The Connecticut Food Bank reports that between 2003 and 2004, the amount of food distributed to needy families increased by 27% and still didn't meet the need. High costs for housing, medical care, and utilities are the main reasons why families sometimes can't afford food. And if paying the heating bill was tough last year for poor families, a much bigger crisis looms this winter. The cost of heating oil and natural gas has skyrocketed as a direct result of energy sources knocked out by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Ed Madison runs a mental health program in New Haven and serves on the city's Board of Aldermen. Madison estimates that 4,000 families are likely to be affected.
The other group that we're extremely concerned about are elderly people. Well, for elderly people, their need is for pretty moderate temperatures is greater than the rest of us. I mean, you can't tell an 80-year-old person to put a sweater on. They put every sweater in the house on, and they're still freezing cold. So that could lead to, you know, serious illness and deaths. Only the federal government really has the resources. If they chose to provide them, it would take a revolutionary change at the federal level to be able to supply people with what they minimally need.
Columbus House is New Haven's oldest and largest homeless shelter. But unlike the old model, where guests had to vacate the building from early morning until late afternoon, the new facility is buzzing with clients and staff holding all kinds of meetings and trainings. Executive Director Allison Cunningham runs the shelter and several related programs. She says the number of homeless people in New Haven has increased steadily over the past few years, especially among single women, many of whom are mothers who have lost custody of their children. The reason often is homelessness. Cunningham says that Americans are most often generous at a distance, giving to tsunami, earthquake, and hurricane relief.
But when it comes to facing disaster at your doorstep, I believe it's a little different story. And we don't look at homelessness as a disaster anymore. And I think that's our problem, that homelessness is a given. Poverty is a given. It's part of the fabric of society that unfortunately we've come to accept.
Private landlords offered rent-free apartments to Katrina evacuees. Business owners created jobs to help them out, while others were prepared to donate new beds to the 400 evacuees expected to arrive. But now, even though most of this is no longer needed, all those goods and services are not being offered to local people in need. For Making Contact, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, and Yasuyu Nagata. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production, funded primarily by generous gifts from people in the community. We are committed to providing a unique forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. For a CD copy of program number 0206, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, outreach coordinator, Tom Evans, development associate, Emily Polk, production fellow, and Megan Kaiser, production intern. I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.